Today we are returning to the seventh chapter of Esther. We left off right before this last week. And of course, last week represented the main turning point in the story as a sleepless night ordained by God began to move events in a surprising direction, and very quickly, Haman is humbled, Mordecai is exalted and vindicated. But of course, that was in between the efforts that Esther was going to make on behalf of the Jewish people as a whole. So even though things began moving in such an encouraging direction in the providence of God, the main problem of the story still has not been resolved. We certainly have hope that it will be based on what's happened so far, but now we're going to see how things unfold again through the mighty providence of God. And there is a special focus in this chapter on the negative consequences of these events for Haman specifically. This is a very gratifying chapter when it comes to seeing God vindicate and work on behalf of his people, but it is also a very stark chapter and a very dark chapter as we consider the implications of this for this one man, the enemy of God's people, Haman. And to prepare us for that, I'm going to read something for you that parallels in modern times the sort of theme that we're going to see here and what it is that God is doing through these events in the life of Haman. Last week, I started off talking a little bit about Winston Churchill. Today, I'm going to talk about one of his great enemies, the Italian dictator Benito Mussolini. And you may know that it was actually quite a bit before the Second World War was over that things turned sour for him. And actually, in 1943, he was arrested by the Allied forces and contained. So he was humiliated at that point, and yet pretty quickly that same year, there was a group of Nazi commandos that basically invaded the place where he was being kept in southern Italy and rescued him from his exile there. And he was set up as the leader by Hitler over northern Italy as a puppet country of the Germans. And even though at that point he started back into his rule and had some efforts and some comforts and some idea that things were going well or that things would turn out well for him, of course we know that by 1945, the tide of the war had turned against the Axis powers. And when he learned on April 25th that the Nazis were actually negotiating an unconditional surrender toward the Allied forces, he was angry and he had to scramble to figure out what he would do next. And I read to you here from an article by Christopher Klein. Mussolini stormed out of the palace in Milan, and he fled Milan with his 33-year-old mistress, Clara Petacci, in the 1939 Alfa Romeo sport car he had bought as a gift for his girlfriend. The following day, the pair joined a convoy of fellow fascist and German soldiers heading north toward Lake Como and the border with Switzerland. Mussolini donned a German Luftwaffe helmet and overcoat, but the disguise did little to save him when partisans stopped the convoy at the lakeside town of Dongo on April 27th. For 20 years, Mussolini had built a cult of personality with his image emblazoned on posters and newspapers. Now the familiarity of his distinctive shaved head and granite jaw, even in disguise, did him in. The partisans seized Mussolini and Petacci. Fearing that the Nazis would again try to liberate the dictator, they hid the pair in a remote farmhouse for the night. The following day, Mussolini and Petacci were removed from the house and driven to the small village of Giulino di Mezzegra on the shores of Lake Como. They were ordered to stand in front of a stone wall at the entrance to Via Belmonte, where both were executed by machine gun fire. The identity of the trigger man remains a point of contention, but it was likely communist partisan commander Walter Audisio. There's no uncertainty, however, about what happened to Mussolini's body in the hours after his execution. In the pre-dawn hours of April 29, the corpses of Mussolini, Patacci, and 14 fellow fascists were placed in a truck and dumped like garbage in Milan's Piazzale Loreto, a deeply symbolic public square for the anti-fascist forces. There, 8 months earlier, fascists acting under orders from Hitler's SS publicly displayed the bodies of 15 executed partisans. After Mussolini's arrest in July 1943, jubilant crowds mutilated images of the dictator. Now, as the sun rose on the square of the 15 martyrs, residents of Milan had the chance to do the same thing, only this time for real. They hurled invectives and vegetables at the dictator's corpse before kicking, beating, and spitting upon it. One woman, deciding Mussolini wasn't dead enough for her, emptied a pistol into the dictator's body and shouted, "Five shots for my five assassinated sons." The crowd then strung the bodies of Mussolini, Patacci, and other fascists by their feet from the girders of a gasoline station in a corner of the square. And it actually gets more gruesome as the author goes on to describe the fate of his body for years to come, and the abuse that even a dead body experienced as people were unleashing their vengeance against this man that it had done so much evil against them and against their country. These are the gory realities of warfare. And this is the end, often, of defeated forces and highly hated leaders. And in the providence of God, something very much like that happened in the life of this man, Haman. And it wasn't a one-time thing. And it wasn't just the unleashing of somebody's vengeance or anger. The Bible speaks strongly about God's judgment of the wicked and his opposition toward those who stand in the way of his purposes and in the way of his people. I want to share with you a couple of verses that describe very powerfully what we find in the chapter for today. This is Psalm 7. "Behold, the wicked man conceives evil and is pregnant with mischief and gives birth to lies. He makes a pit, digging it out, and falls into the hole that he has made." And we could say, adapting that for this book, he makes a gallows 75 feet high and ends up hung on that very same device of destruction. The passage goes on to say, "His mischief returns upon his own head, and on his own skull his violence descends." And how are you supposed to respond when you hear about somebody's judgment or execution that way? Yes, there is a part of the Christian ethic that looks upon suffering wicked people with pity, not just for their state, but for the condition of the heart that led to that suffering. And yet at the same time, at some point, if God is God, God has to work out justice against his enemies. And so in this passage, when the psalmist is reflecting on what the Lord did or would do for the enemies, his response is actually a response of worship. It is a response of praise to the Lord who worked out vengeance. He says, "I will give to the Lord the thanks due to his righteousness." The Lord has been right or straight. He has conformed to the standards of his law in bringing destruction against the wicked. "And I will sing praise to the name of the Lord, the Most High." That is a part of the response to a passage like we're looking at this morning. As difficult and as bloody and as painful as it is, it still is a reflection of the unswerving justice of God and something for which the Lord deserves the praise of his people. And Proverbs 29 goes on to put it this way: when the wicked increase, transgression increases, but the righteous will look upon their downfall. I'm taking that wording for the title of the message this morning. As we think about Esther chapter 7 and the fate of Haman, this is a passage that depicts for us the downfall of the wicked. Now, that it doesn't sound like a very upbeat and encouraging theme to be considering this morning. And you may also wonder, what in the world does that have to do with the Lord's table that we're celebrating? I do hope that we will draw not only some practical lessons, but some perspective on our God and on his work that actually will have the effect of leading us to worship and humility before him. The downfall of the wicked. That downfall doesn't happen until the very end of the chapter, but we want to consider the setup for it in verses 1 to 7, where Esther is the one who is heavily at work to be the instrument of God to accomplish the judgment. And so what's happening here is that through her, divine providence is indicting this wicked man, Haman. Let's read together verses 1 to 7. You can follow along as I start in verse 1. So the king and Haman went into feast with Queen Esther. And on the second day, as they were drinking wine after the feast, the king again said to Esther, "What is your wish, Queen Esther? It shall be granted you. And what is your request? Even to the half of my kingdom it shall be fulfilled." Then Queen Esther answered, "If I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be granted me for my wish, and my people for my request. For we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. If we had been sold merely as slaves, men and women, I would have been silent, for our affliction is not to be compared with the loss to the king." Then King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther, "Who is he? And where is he who has dared to do this?" And Esther said, "A foe and enemy, this wicked Haman." Then Haman was terrified before the king and the queen. Verse 7, "And the king arose in his wrath from the wine drinking and went into the palace garden. But Haman stayed to beg for his life from Queen Esther, for he saw that harm was determined against him by the king." Let's break down those verses and see how it is that, again, through the working of Esther, the Lord in his providence is indicting the wicked. As we look at the first two verses, this sounds very much like Xerxes and what we have seen about him before. He is rash, he is impulsive, and at this point now, for the third time, he promises to her that whatever she asks, he's going to give her up to half of his kingdom. That is an immense amount of land. It is an immense amount of people. It is an immense amount of money. And he is saying, "I'm going to give you half of everything that I am ruling over." Whether he actually meant it or was just a big talker like so many politicians are, he is still putting himself and his reputation on the line by making such a promise to her. And if you're thinking ahead a little bit, you maybe remember that he is not the only rash, foolish ruler that ever talked this way. And centuries later, there was a man by the name of Herod who sort of painted himself into a corner when at a feast he says, "I'm going to give you, Herodias, up to half of my kingdom." And what is asked is not the kingdom, but the head of John the Baptist. And in order to protect his reputation in front of all those people that heard him say that, He has to do something that he was loath to do, this utterly unjust act of chopping off the head of a righteous prophet of God. Well, that's the sort of thing that these rulers are willing to do to save face. And this is the way that this man is talking to her as well, so that as a reader, even though you are so frustrated with Xerxes and his the ability of people to just manipulate him and his impulsiveness, there really is no plan for how he goes about making decisions. It's on the spot, whatever he feels like, whatever he feels pressure to do. Well, in this case, if you're on the other side, you're viewing that as a good thing, because he has, in effect, obligated himself to do whatever it is that Esther asked for. And as we go on in this passage, it is just so impressive how this woman continues to demonstrate shrewdness in her negotiation with the emperor. And what we see her as in these verses is like a prosecuting attorney who is making a case, who is bringing out evidence, who is working skillfully to put the defendant in the corner and unable to defend himself. And there's just a masterful strategy that she follows here, reflecting the sort of thing that we have seen already in this book. Let's take a look at that. Consider, first of all, how even before making the request, she is appealing to what she knows makes this man tick. She says there in verse 3, "If I have found favor in your sight." And remember all the language about her currying favor. And she is appealing to successes that she has already had and the fact that he has already shown her favor. And then she says, "If I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it pleased the king." Remember that language. Literally, it says, "if it is good to the king." And there's all this language leading up to this that demonstrates the hedonism of this man and how he goes on the basis of sight, and whatever seems like it's good to him and however it makes him feel, that's what drives him. And she is skillfully appealing to what she knows about his own character and what she knows about the way he makes decisions. And then she gets to the request itself. "Let my life be granted me for my wish, and my people for my request." Do you notice anything about that terminology? He had just said to her, back in verse 2, "Queen Esther," at the beginning, "what is your wish?" And then, "what is your request?" Those are synonymous terms, but he is using two different terms to emphasize, "I really want to know what you want." And she picks up on them, but she kind of separates them out. And she says, "Here is what I am asking. Let my life be granted to me for my wish, and my people for my request." What do you see there? She is not only echoing his language again to put him in an awkward position, because she's just following up on what he had just said, but she is doing it in a way that it's going to be impossible to separate her from her people. "My wish is my life. My request, really all in the same package, is for my people. We are one and the same here. This is not just a personal matter. It's not just a matter of you protecting me as your wife. I go along with this whole group of people that has been condemned to destruction, and I am pleading with you for the life of all of us." Very interesting how she words that. And it's also interesting that she does not start out by saying, "This guy over here, Haman, it's his fault. I'm talking about him." She waits until the most appropriate, the most powerful moment to bring up that it is Haman. She begins talking in general terms against the threat against herself and her people, but she withholds a pretty important piece of information as to how all this started and why it was that she invited this man to this banquet. Again, reflecting wisdom in her gradual approach. And then what else does she say? As she elaborates, what is the threat against her people? Verse 4, "We have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated." She didn't just make up those words. Those words are precisely the words of the decree that were given to us back in chapter 3 and verse 13 as to what it was that Haman had gotten the emperor to agree to, and he gave him the authority to put his seal on that and to make it official. These three verbs that we find there in verse 4, destroyed, killed, annihilated, precisely the wording of the decree. Now, you kind of wonder at this point, as the king is processing all this, whether that rang a bell or whether he was taken up in the moment and that was just kind of a faraway memory. You don't really know what's going through his head or how he's processing this request. But one of the things that's happening here is that little by little and very cautiously and wisely, she is dealing with the problem, but she's also realizing that this is going to put the king in an extremely awkward position because he is the one that authorized that decree. So how is she going to get him to favor her and free her people, but still not undermine him and not make him look as bad as he really does look in the eyes of those who are reading, in the eyes of his people? Well, listen to what she says next here as she gives her final appeal. "If we had been sold merely as slaves, men and women, I would have been silent, for our affliction is not to be compared with the loss to the king." You're like, what in the world is she saying? She is a consummate politician, where sometimes you have to read what they're saying three or four times and sort of think sideways to get the logic of how they get to their conclusion. Here's what she's doing. She is appealing to this man's self-interest in a very specific way. And this is pretty crazy when you think about all the things she could have said. This is unfair. This is murder. This is wrong. Haman has fooled you, right? She could have used any number of arguments. But what she says is actually, you know what? This is actually going to hurt you ultimately, king. If we were talking about somebody just going to enslave us, at least my people would still be in the kingdom. And at least they would still be contributing to the bottom line of the kingdom by helping your economy and by growing prosperity in the empire. But it's not like that. If that was all that it was, I wouldn't even bother you with this. It wouldn't be worth your time because, after all, this man enslaved people all the time. And he was very used to abusing others to build his buildings and grow his influence and his empire. She says, if that's all that it was, then I would leave it alone because at least you would still be profiting. But look, all these people are going to be wiped out according to this decree. You've lost all this workforce. You have lost all the taxes or the tribute that you are requiring from these people. That is the sort of argument that she is making here as she appeals to this man's self-interest. And this kind of thing has come up before. I've got there on the slides a couple of verses earlier. You can turn back there to chapter 3 and verses 8 and 9. And this is where Haman is working to get Xerxes to make the decree in the first place. And here is the way he argues. There is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of every other people. They do not keep the king's laws, so that it is not to the king's profit to tolerate them. Notice how, again, he is appealing to the king's self-interest. And he's speaking there about the social unrest that could easily result from the fact that the Jewish people had these other customs, and implying that they weren't going to obey the laws of the land, that they were going to be trouble, and this is not going to help you in the end. And therefore, for your own bottom line, for your profit, authorize me to wipe them out. And as we saw when we were dealing with this passage, he offers him a bunch of money that probably would have come from looting the property of the people that would have been slaughtered, a huge amount, 10,000 talents of silver, that perhaps would obscure the fact that on the longer term, these people wouldn't be paying taxes. And the point is that this is the way that people, apparently on a regular basis, were arguing their case before Xerxes to get him on their side. Esther, again, knows how this man thinks, and she says, it's not to your benefit, it's not to your profit to let this happen. Just a masterful way that she goes about making this case. Well, how is Haman going to respond? This was really, can I say this, fun for me to read this in the original language, particularly at this point in the story, because the syntax is so awkward, and it is so outside the norm of how a Hebrew sentence would normally be set up, and it reflects very much of a choppy sort of a wording and a kind of a staccato approach to what is being said here that goes along the wording at this highest moment of tension and emotion and anger. The wording of it even goes along with the feeling of shock that this man is experiencing, that he is portraying here. Let me read it to you in a more word-for-word fashion. In fact, when it starts, before he even speaks, then the king Ahasuerus said, and he said to Esther the queen. It almost reads like the narrator in introducing this is kind of stuttering, because he uses the word said twice, and the first time doesn't give a quote. And then the king said, and he said, and this very quick and kind of rough syntax, and then what he actually said. Who is he, this one? And where is this one? He whose heart has filled him to do thus. There is a sense of anger and outrage and the need to step up and do something about this immediately because of how disturbing this was, even to the king. And as well, in the way that Esther responds, the emphasis of her wording goes along with the fact that this is the climax of her accusation. She leaves the most important part to the end as far as actually naming who is responsible for the annihilation that had been decreed against her people. And again, literally, this says, a man, an adversary and enemy, Haman, this evil one. And those are her last words. Kind of reminds me of the setup that Nathan the prophet did when he was gradually working to get David to recognize and confess his sin. And he tells him the story, leaves out a very important piece that he's actually talking about David. And when David gets all upset, this is an outrage. I can't tolerate this kind of thing in my kingdom. And he says, thou art the man. And he leaves the identification of the guilty party to the very end. That's exactly the approach that Esther has taken here. Now, what is going to be the fallout for Haman? But I think we also need to ask the question, what is going to be the fallout for the king? You got to think about this from his perspective as well, and the very difficult position that he found himself in, that is alluded to as you look at the rest of verse 6 and into verse 7. Clearly, Haman is afraid. And again, it's strong wording as you come to his response at the end of verse 6. Haman was terrified, or he was overtaken by terror before the king and the queen. And at the end of verse 7, he stays to beg for his life from Queen Esther because he saw that harm or evil was determined against him by the king. And that word evil there, translated harm, is the same idea of evil that she had just used to describe him. The evil man deserves evil to come upon him, and he knows that. And so one of the dilemmas in this passage is the problem that Haman is dealing with and his fear that it's all come crashing down on him. But that's not the only issue. There are twin dilemmas here. It's not just Haman, but it is also Xerxes, who finds himself in the sticky position of how to get out of something that he himself had authorized. And when it says in verse 7, the king arose in his wrath from the wine drinking and went into the palace garden, you say, well, I can understand that. He's just ticked. He's angry. He is hurt that here his best counselor had tricked him into doing this. He is filled with regret, and this is a very personal struggle, so he goes out there to count to 10 or something to calm down before he can think rationally to know what to do. I was listening to a podcast this week about something else regarding World War II, about Dwight Eisenhower, and how when he was in the presidency, he had developed this tactic for how he would deal with it when he was angry. And maybe you've had to do this sort of thing sometimes too, where when he was really upset with somebody, which he wasn't known for angry responses. He was known for being a very calm, cool, collected individual. But one reason he could do that is whenever he was angry, he would actually take out a piece of paper and he would write down the person's name and everything that happened and how he was feeling and everything. And he would take that piece of paper and then he would just throw it away. It was like a way of getting this off of his chest and sort of dealing with it symbolically, and that helped him to cope. And then when he was in the presidency, evidently instead of throwing it in the trash, he got in the habit of throwing it into a drawer in the desk. And so the question is, you know, how much the cleaning lady knew about the personal struggles of Eisenhower as she went up and cleaned up after him. That's not all that's going on here, that this man is just really mad and he's got to cool down. He's got to figure out, he's in a bind here. How am I going to undo this when supposedly the law of the Persians is fixed and cannot be altered? It's not just about Haman undermining him, it's about the position he finds himself in as the emperor and the fact that his reputation is on the line, as well as his wife and as well as all these people. What is he going to do? And so he rushes out there very disturbed, no doubt, to try to figure out what it is he's going to do to get out of this mess. And that brings us to the end of that part. It's like the lights go down. You see Xerxes run off into the garden. You see Haman pleading for his life. And in just a quick moment, the lights come back on and you're on to the next part of the story. And what do we see here? It is not only that divine providence indicts the wicked, demonstrating beyond any possibility of controversy or doubt or pushback that this man's guilty. Now, what's going to happen about that? What's God going to do about this? Divine providence not only indicts the wicked, divine providence condemns the wicked. Works out his verdict and enacts that verdict to where by the end of the story, really in just a few verses, this man is executed with a similar kind of rage and sense of vengeance as what happened to Mussolini. Divine providence condemns the wicked. And how things worked out in the providence of God to give Xerxes a way out, or at least a bit of a path forward here, is just uncanny. As you go into verse 8, you find a bit of a solution to Xerxes' dilemma. And a reason, or we might even say an excuse, for getting rid of Haman, because he would have really been raising questions about himself to get rid of Haman about a law that he had authorized. He's got to find some other way to get rid of this man, legally, or at least in a way that wouldn't make him look so bad. And how does that happen? Look at verse 8. And the king returned from the palace garden to the place where they were drinking wine. As Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was. We call that a compromising position that you put yourself in. Unintentionally ending up in that spot, doing anything to Esther was the furthest thing, I'm sure, from his mind. He's pleading for his life, and yet in the very moment that he is making that kind of drastic and questionable approach to the queen, at that very moment, the king happens to walk in. That is what we call perfect timing. And it is fascinating that the way it's described here is that he fell, or he was falling. Because that terminology of fall has been used at other key moments in this book. And I want to just highlight these verses for you to help us put all this together. Chapter 3, verse 7. It's not evident in our English translation, but it is the same Hebrew term for falling when it says they cast lots, they caused to fall lots. That's a term, same root that you find here. In other words, this threat against the Jews all started with something falling or being caused to fall. And then look ahead at chapter 6 and verse 10. What's happening there? Chapter 6 and verse 10 is where things begin to turn to the better for Mordecai. And it says at the end, let out nothing that you have mentioned. Again, it's not apparent in the English, but what the king says is don't let anything fall, as in fall to the ground or as in go to nothing, that you have mentioned that should be done to the man that I want to honor. And then the word actually occurs three times. We saw this last week in verse 13 when Haman comes back to his family, tells them what happened. If Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of the Jewish people, you will not overcome him, but you will falling fall, is what that says literally. So this story has been, in a sense, about things falling. About the lot falling, about nothing falling that Haman was trying, had said, and about Haman himself beginning to fall before Mordecai, and now he is really falling. On his face, on his knees, begging for his life from Queen Esther. And that does look very strange to somebody just observing or walking in without having heard the conversation up to that point or having the context. And it's a pretty drastic thing for this man to do. Actually, according to one of the Jewish versions of this story, the angel Gabriel actually pushed Haman to fall before her. And I talked last week about how they sometimes added to the Bible to make it more theological. And that's what they say at this point. But nevertheless, he is there before the queen. And when Xerxes sees it, he is incensed even more and takes this in a personal way, as though somehow this man was trying to assault or to rape or something Esther. It's an exaggerated accusation. It's quite the claim to be making that anybody would be so foolish to try to pull something off like that in that place at that moment after everything that just happened. but it gave him a convenient basis for doing away with Haman. And that happens at the very moment that he walks back in the room. That's no coincidence. Now you say, why did he get away with this? And, you know, how could he do this when it wasn't true? Well, people have studied the laws that we have from the Persian Empire, and there were laws about the harem. And actually, there's a law that says that unless you're the king, you're not to come within 7 footsteps of a woman from the harem, be it a queen or a concubine. So that was like the original social distancing. Okay? And he violated that. So there was actually a legal sort of basis, or at least an excuse in their laws for this man to take this drastic action. And then the very last thing you read in that particular verse, as the word left the mouth of the king, and he says, will he even assault the queen in my presence in my own house? They covered Haman's face. And we have seen that kind of language as well. Back in chapter 4, it was Mordecai and it was his people that were covering themselves in sackcloth and ashes, mourning and crying out for mercy, confused, overwhelmed by grief and fear. That was the covering at that point. At the end of chapter 6, after Haman has to honor Mordecai, it says that he covered his head. Remember that from last time? He went home in shame, covering his head. And now here is the last covering, and it indicates symbolically it's over. You're done for. And people's faces usually get covered after they die. You're as good as dead, and we're just going to cover your head. Nobody in here is going to see your face anymore. You are doomed to destruction. And how is he going to be destroyed? And this is the last little part of this passage, the ironic execution that takes place in verses 9 and 10. And you got this guy speaking up seemingly out of nowhere. His name is Harbona. He actually had been mentioned once before in a list of eunuchs of the king. And in verse 9 says, then Harbona, one of the eunuchs in attendance on the king, said, moreover, the gallows that Haman has prepared for Mordecai, whose words save the king, is standing at Haman's house 50 cubits high. And the king said, hang him on that. So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Then the wrath of the king abated. Again, connect us to earlier parts of the story. When Haman stood up for the king and he heard about this conspiracy against him and he reported that and the king's life was spared, that had to do with a couple of eunuchs that were traitors, were trying to kill Xerxes. And it says in chapter 2 that that report led to the execution of 2 treasonous eunuchs on gallows, and now precisely another eunuch suggests the perfect gallows on which to execute another traitor, namely Haman. And it's just fascinating how there's this, these things echo each other. History sort of doesn't exactly repeat itself, but it does rhyme. It echoes in the providence of God. It's just a perfect correspondence. Poetic justice is what we call that. And then there's also this, that the replacement of Mordecai by Haman on the gallows, if they were replaced as far as who is going to die on those gallows, it leads to the anticipation, or at least the possibility and the hope that maybe Mordecai is going to replace Haman in the court. In other words, they're going to flip-flop. The one that was going to die on the gallows will go back to the court and take the place of the bad guy that actually does die on the gallows. Does that make sense? And I had to look at this again because I keep getting Haman and Mordecai, their names confused. I hope the slide is right on that point. Hopefully you understand what I'm saying here. There is a total flip-flop of these two. which is exactly what, we won't come there today, but at the beginning of the next chapter, what happens is that Mordecai is promoted to that same basic position, a total replacement in the providence and in the justice of God. Well, looking back on all of that, what would we say to summarize this story? That God sovereignly orchestrates the punishment of those who oppose his purposes. In different ways so far in the story, I've been talking about God orchestrates events or people's choices to accomplish his purposes and all of that. But here it's, how is he going to deal with those who are standing in opposition to him and his people and what he intends to do? God is well able, creatively, through circumstances, through other people, to get his enemies out of the way and to eliminate the opposition totally. That's the point of this chapter. God sovereignly orchestrates the punishment of those who oppose his purposes. And when I read these stories, and I keep coming up with all these fascinating connections and seeing how these things unfold so perfectly, I'm thinking, Esther is a genius when it comes to what she did to work this out. And then I say the narrator of the story is a genius to be able to craft all these things literally the way he did to make it all work out this way. And then I say, no, actually, God's a genius. God's the one who put Esther in that place, and God was the one who directed her steps and used her. He led the author to tell us the story the way he did. God is the one who is sovereignly arranging all of these things, in this case, to punish Haman. And here's a statement about that from the great theologian B.B. Warfield. He says, in the infinite wisdom of the Lord of all the earth, each event falls with exact precision into its proper place in the unfolding of his divine plan. Nothing, however small, however strange, occurs without his ordering or without its particular fitness for its place in the working out of his purpose. Every little detail, people, circumstances, timing, how, when, where, everything, every smallest part of it, with precision in its place, is being superintended to work out what the Lord is doing. And that includes his judgment of the wicked. And there's a verse about that as well. Here's Proverbs 16:4. It says, the Lord works out everything to its proper end, even the wicked for a day of disaster. God's enemies who are raging against him are not in control of their destiny. They will not only fail in their efforts to oppose him, but they will be swallowed up in judgment if they don't repent. Now, as we try to apply that to our lives, what should we be getting out of that? There are a lot of applications, I think, in the scope of the story as a whole. This is part of encouraging God's people to trust him for vindication. And so we could talk about how this gives us hope that the Lord is going to bring justice whenever we are unjustly treated and opposed. We're going to see that point especially in the passage next week. So that is appropriate, but since so much of this has been about Haman, and so much of it has been about his judgment, God's judgment on him, I think more immediately we ought to see a strong warning here about what happens when people try to oppose the purposes of God. And as we think about that, we're thinking probably in the main about unbelievers and sort of visible and hostile enemies of the church and those that persecute us, and that's all true. But let us not think that in our flesh, even as believers, there isn't something like Haman as well that needs to be challenged, that needs to be sobered, that needs to be warned. And so I want to leave you with these thoughts along those lines. It is a mercy of God that we have hard passages like this in the Bible. And any time you read a story or a prophecy about judgment, there is an implicit message. If you go down this path, this is what you can expect. The day of reckoning is going to come for you as well. You can't avoid it. You cannot resist it. And it's actually a gracious and a kind thing of God to give you these stories so that you will see, so that you will not go down that path. Be warned. Receive it as a mercy of God. Recognize as well that really any time we sin, there is something like Haman going on in our hearts. We look at him and there's so much there about pride and ambition and using people and getting people out of the way that stand in the way of his agenda. It's just an inflated ego is what that is. And at the end of the day, that is behind all of our sin. A distorted preoccupation with self. What I like and how I feel and what makes me feel significant. And getting my way and getting my position and getting others to respect me. This distorted preoccupation with self, this Haman-like trait is what is driving us whenever we sin against the Lord. And so as we realize that, we're being called here to repent. To see that for the idolatry that it is. To see that as the elevation of self to the place of God. And call it what it is. And in your heart, hate it and turn from it. And call out to the Lord to change your affections at that moment. But it's not as though that sort of thing is just going to disappear because you repented of it once. The fact is that we are in this battle. Believers are in this battle between the flesh and the spirit, and every day, moment by moment, by the Spirit's power, we are doing battle. I'm doing battle, you're doing battle against this inclination to elevate myself to the place of prominence in whatever realm, in whatever, it could be a million different ways that it shows up. But this is the battle internally that we're facing. And so we're being called here to fight with the weapons of the Spirit against this proudful inclination. And ultimately, we look to the Lord Jesus Christ for our deliverance. For the forgiveness of our sins, through his blood-shedding death on the cross, and for the power that he gives us through union with him to do that fight. Now, I'm going back to Esther here quickly to point out one comment in chapter 7 that I haven't said anything about. But it's actually the last line at the end of verse 10. And I have tried throughout this series not to, quote-unquote, spiritualize and see a lot of symbolism or see something as a type of something else if there's no basis for it in the text. And I'm not saying this is a symbol, but I'm saying there's a truth here that has the ultimate expression in the gospel. Did you pick up on this after they hanged Haman? So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he prepared for Mordecai. Then the wrath of the king abated. His wrath was poured out. The judgment was unleashed on the guilty party. And the king settled down as well. Satisfaction was made. And so there's nothing left to be angry about. Do you realize that is exactly what happened on the cross of Jesus Christ? We're the Hamans that should have been on that cross. The Father pours out his wrath on him. And as we experience by faith the application of that to our lives, the Father, his wrath is abated. He has nothing to be angry about anymore because it's all been unleashed already. It's all been fully satisfied. And that is what the Lord's Supper is about. And so we find there at the cross the ultimate solution for the struggle of our pride, both the forgiveness that we need when we fail and the power that we need to keep fighting. It has all been obtained, purchased by the blood of the Lord Jesus Christ.